This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to talk about serious illness. Our guest is Dr. Robert Martinson. How does one begin to navigate the issues and questions that arise in serious illness? How do you sort through them? How do you choose or decline aggressive treatment? How do we prepare for the issues that confront us at the end of life? Dr. Robert Martinson, a physician, medical historian, and bioethicist, has treated tens of thousands of patients in emergency rooms and intensive care units. He is the author of A Life Worth Living, A Doctor's Reflections on Illness in a High-Tech Era. Through the stories of people, of patients and their families, grappling with serious illness, Dr. Martinson offers us a way to begin thinking about dealing with illness and preparing for death, whether our own or that of a loved one. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your thoughts. You can join us with your questions and comments with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. A Life Worth Living is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Martinson, good afternoon. Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Celeste.
How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Could we begin with the story of Eliza?
Eliza, yes. Eliza was the mother of a friend of mine, and Eliza's situation is that of many people who have not had many medical problems for a long time in their lives, and then when they're over age 80, one thing or another starts going wrong. Eliza was 85 when she noticed that she was having trouble breathing, and one of the enjoyments of Eliza's life was being able to go for a daily walk with her dogs. She lived in Southern California and had spent her whole married life. She was a widow for 10 years, lived where she could walk on the beach every day or in a canyon, and had been very vigorous, was still working at age 85 as a screenwriter. And what she found when she couldn't breathe, she went to her internist, who sent her to a cardiologist, who sent her to a cardiac surgeon. And after approximately an 8-minute conversation, she and he decided to replace her mitral valve, which is a main valve in the heart. And replacement of the valve, it was thought, would improve her breathing. She had the operation. She had it at a good place. It was technically a success. No post-op complications, out of the hospital, and Eliza discovered that she could no longer remember things, that she had a severe cognitive problem. She was aware that she couldn't remember, and the level of her not being able to remember, her short-term memory was gone, so that she would call her son, who is a friend of mine, 10 times a day. She lived in L.A., he lived in San Francisco. And she couldn't remember that she called him 30 minutes previously and was in despair. And the reason I wanted to talk about Eliza is that had the conversation been more in-depth with her specialist, this cardiac surgeon, he might have learned that what really mattered to Eliza was maintaining her mind as alertly as possible for as long as possible. In other words, if one had said to Eliza, you know, this is the problem, your mitral valve, the main pumping chamber of your heart, isn't able to work as effectively as it was, and that's why you're short of breath more than you used to be. If we replace the valve, percentage of patients, particularly older patients, who have that valve replaced during the course of the operation because they're on bypass pumps will have severe problems with memory or other mental functions. If Eliza had known that, she said afterwards, I would have gone for an oxygen bottle. I would have been fine. Instead, she lived for approximately 2 years after her surgery in progressive debility and in despair. And I think that one of the most poignant issues in American healthcare is to talk with people fully in presenting various options for treatment, because the problems that we develop in late life are chronic problems. Medicine doesn't have cures for them. We, and by we I mean doctors in the healthcare complex, have lots of treatments. But whether a treatment is the right way to go or the least bad way to go for somebody really depends on that individual person, what they value, what their loyalties are, what their living situation is like, a whole host of factors. It's not the same as treating a child who has bacterial meningitis with the appropriate antibiotic as soon as possible, when one knows the treatment will cure the problem. The issue is really one of how does one live with these serious chronic problems. I'm going on a bit, but...
Well, another interesting issue that this chapter raises, and it's a very important one, is where is the primary care physician? Eliza went to specialist to specialist to specialist, but there was like no overall, she wasn't with someone she'd known for a long time. Like I would imagine she had a primary care physician, and somehow or other that...
That link got lost once she went from primary care to specialist number two. The link with the primary care was lost, and it's part of a larger pattern. When one looks, I think most people assume that more care is better, and specialty care, since people are really trained in an organ system and a set of procedures or interventions, that getting the best specialist or range of specialists leads to the best results. And so people who are intelligent, savvy, think, well, I need to get to the best specialist for all my problems. And that's been studied. It's been studied by a group called the Dartmouth Health Atlas. And what they've found, if you compare areas where there are lots of specialists and people are going to specialists all the time, in other words, very high specialty usage, and compared those areas to areas where there are not so many specialists, but they're very good primary care networks, what the Dartmouth Health Atlas folks have found is that people who live where there are more primary care people and fewer specialists live longer and live more healthily. And the comparison, it's the where there are lots of specialists, one place is Boca Raton, Florida, which is a very affluent enclave in southeast Florida. And the comparison was Pierre, South Dakota. And one would intrinsically think, I think, well, I'll do better in Boca Raton, the climate's milder and so forth. But actually, people do better in Pierre.
Yeah, I was thinking, boy, maybe rural Wisconsin is right for me in my final years.
Well, rural Wisconsin has some very good, it turns out, has some very good kind of networks of primary care physicians.
Yeah.
So it's a good thought.
Here's something interesting. When patients are informed, when they really are carefully informed and they've thought about it and they have a choice between conservative or invasive approaches, they tend to prefer the conservative approach. That seems, maybe it shouldn't be surprising, but maybe it was to me.
Yes, it is. In general, American approaches are more aggressive than European approaches for almost any condition in which one can do an operative intervention. and particularly when there's cancer. And this has been true for a long time. And what one finds, however, is if patients get what are called decision guides. So suppose one's a guy and you find out you have prostate cancer. When groups have been compared, one group who gets a decision guide that maps out the options and their outcomes, and another group doesn't get a decision guide, just kind of goes to urologists and surgeons. The group who has the decision guide elects to have the prostate removed 40% less often. They elect to have less aggressive surgery. And yet their outcomes, given the same level of prostate cancer, are the same or better. So that I think there's that sense of being fully informed is vital. And in some settings, it's some decision guides are available on the internet, and some are available in large groups. A large prepaid group, particularly on the West Coast, is Kaiser Permanente. And they've been pioneers in developing decision guides for conditions like prostate cancer that affect, you know, a large number of people, breast cancer for women and so forth. And when those guides have been used and people can actually read through and kind of get a sense of what can lie ahead given different approaches, people tend to elect the procedures that are less invasive, less aggressive, if you will, that have similar or better outcome statistics.
And should we also ask or demand that our primary care physician be included in the care that we receive?
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
Yes. It's often that link, particularly when people are referred from a small or medium-sized town to a major urban academic medical center or hospital. The primary care physician falls out of the loop. They're not kept in the process, and yet it's the primary care physician who knows the patient, knows the family, and has a sense of the patient as a person, not just an organ system.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Robert Martinson. He's the author of A Life Worth Living, A Doctor's Reflections on Illness in a High-Tech Era. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest is a physician, medical historian, and bioethicist. He's treated many, many people in emergency rooms and intensive care units. He is currently director of the Office of History and Museum at the National Institutes of Health. He also serves on the faculty of the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to talk next about children, but before we go to children, maybe you would tell us about a Swiss demographer named Arthur Imhoff.
Oh, yes. Well, and I think Imhoff's findings are particularly relevant to what we talked about a couple minutes ago, the situation of people over 80 who are having problems with a failing part of their body or organ system. What Arthur Imhoff wanted to look at was the question, what was it like if one was 80 a long time ago, compared to what was it like if one was 80 today? How long could you expect to live? And in order to research that question, he looked at German lifespan records, because the Germans had very good parish records of lifespan, something you couldn't do in the United States, which obviously didn't exist 400 years ago. So he looked in 1600 in Berlin, and what he found was if one were a woman aged 80, now there weren't very many, but if one were 80 years old in Berlin in 1600, almost 400 years ago, one could expect on average to live to age 86. And then he looked in the late 1980s at 80-year-old women in Berlin, and he found that if one were 80 in the late 1980s in Berlin, one's average life expectancy was an additional 8 years, or age 88. So that when you stand back and look at it and say, well, what's 400 years meant in terms of medical progress for people who are age 80, on average in this study it meant one lived approximately 2 more years. So that we by implication, we get lots of intensive, aggressive care often when we're in our mid to late 80s. And that is not benign. That causes suffering all by itself. And what is the outcome? And what's different, of course, is today many people spend their last year of their lives, if they're in their mid to late 80s, just in a shuttle between home or nursing home, hospital, emergency room, hospital, back and forth.
Why?
Having treatments and treatments and treatments till there's no more bodily response. And they die. Now, the rub was in 1600, old age was an accepted cause of death. In the United States today, it's not permissible to say if somebody, even somebody 102, he or she just died of old age. You know, the implication is always to keep treating.
Why does that shuttle take place? Why all that back and forth?
Well, I think an anthropologist named Sharon Kaufman has written about this recently, and so I'm borrowing from her work as I talk about it, but it's also my own experience and other reading. I think what happens is for those in nursing homes in advanced age, the nursing homes don't want to do or say they can't do any kind of intensive treatment, and for them that typically means having an intravenous line, and they're not compensated for it. So they send the patients to the emergency rooms and to the hospitals as soon as they seem a little unstable. The hospitals take the patients in and treat them actively, sometimes intensively. They don't want the patients dying there. Most hospitals are not yet set up to have palliative care areas, although that's changing. So the patient gets temporarily stabilized. Doesn't mean they're better. They're just a little more stable. They're discharged back to their home if they're living with family members or the institution of the nursing home. The disease process goes on. 3 weeks later, they're back in the hospital. They stay for 4 days, they're discharged, and so forth. So it's not uncommon in these situations to read a chart that would begin something like, this is Mrs. Smith's 13th admission to Valley Hospital over the last 14 months. And it's in my view, tragic. And what it reflects is there's really neither in nursing homes nor hospitals have configured themselves. Nobody wants the dying, so they just get bounced back and forth.
Is there a way to, in the case of an individual, put an end to it, either for yourself or if you're able, I mean, if you're that ill, it might be tough, but for an individual or that individual's loved ones?
Yes, there is. And what it requires is that when one is reasonably stable for the person and has their mental faculties, to talk with, ideally with people close to them, and sometimes with hospital staffs, to say, execute an advance directive, whether it's a durable power of attorney for health care, or an advance directive specifying if I can make a decision, I want this done, I do not want this done. If I can't make a decision, I entrust the decisions to my daughter, my son, my husband, my wife. Yes, but it needs to be done early. And then the wrinkle is that the actual forms need to be not only in one's own possession at home, but in the possession at the time of service, in the ambulance, in the hospital record, if possible, with the caregivers, etc. Because often what happens is people show up in an unstable way in an emergency department, and the emergency room team intervenes. If the person can't breathe, you know, you intervene because you don't know the patient's wishes. You know that if you don't do something, they won't be alive for very long. So there are mechanisms, there are means, advanced directives. They're available often on site, online. If one goes to Google and would type in advanced directive Illinois, you'd go to a site that would have pre-printed ones that would be, for which would be applicable for Illinois state law. Same for Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, and so forth. But if it's just left to the default situation where there's no indication from the patient or the patient's family what the patient's wishes are, then the system just kicks in and one ends up on this revolving door shuttle.
Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. Thank you very much for your comments on advanced directives, which I think are very important. On the other hand, I think it's worth noticing something else about Sharon Kaufman's book that you mentioned a moment ago, which is that one of its goals is to explain why advanced directives are so routinely apparently ignored. And her argument is basically that the hospital has its way of doing business, and that way of doing business has a great deal of momentum that's very difficult to slow down. She also points out that people who wind up in repeated acute crises get panicky. Someone has trouble breathing. Someone says, well, Mrs. Jones, would you like us to help you breathe? And next thing you know, the whole armamentarium is brought to bear. So I'd like to know if you could comment further on the subject of the utility of advanced directives.
Well, thanks. I think those are excellent questions, and I agree with your reading of Sharon Kaufman, who happens to be a friend of mine. Everything in the hospitals is geared towards treatment. And I'll say that, after saying that, I want to point out some changes that are some movements that are in the works. Hospitals have not adapted themselves towards palliative approaches. A patient comes in some distress, that is not the time to make decisions long-term about how aggressively that patient should be treated. One of the problems, though, is often even when if the patient has an advanced directive, unless it's in the hands of typically the physicians at the time the dramatic intervention comes to put in an artificial airway, to use mechanical ventilation, to use intensive cardiovascular supports. Unless that is in front of the treating physicians, who are typically in ICUs or ERs, then the intervention is done. The patient is put on the ventilator. Even if the patient had said, I don't want it, if the patient's in distress, meaning respiratory distress or cardiac distress, the things that can kill very quickly, the default response is to treat. Then the next stage, which I think Dr. Kaufman really addresses in this hundreds of case studies she's looked at, are what happens. Okay, that happens. Then what doesn't happen in the hospitals is Mrs. Smith is on a ventilator. Mrs. Smith has no hope of recovery to independent function, to a function that she's indicated she wants. And instead of saying we will try the ventilator for 3 days, a time trial, and see if her acute problem, in pneumonia, for example, improves, and then we will, with her family's permission, withdraw care. Instead, no, Mrs. Smith can stay on that ventilator for 3 or 4 weeks, continually being treated, continually getting various fairly aggressive pharmacological interventions along with mechanical ventilation, because the momentum is in the hospital to keep treating. For one thing, there's a financial aspect to it, but there's also a cultural aspect. People are unwilling to say, let's consider stopping. And this happens when patients come in with very clear directions. I do not want to be kept, I do not want artificial means used to keep me alive if there is little or no prospect that I can, and then whatever the threshold is for that patient, live independently, recover my previous function. You know, there's a whole range of what people want, but it tends to very often be ignored. There's an initial kind of heroic intervention. The patient's stabilized for the moment, and then nothing is ever going to cure the patient's situation. And nobody looks 3 days later, 5 days later, 7 days later, and makes a decision to stop until the situation has gone on for a long time and the family is totally frustrated and demands a decision be made.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're Thanks. Welcome, sir.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener on line 4 in Decatur. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Great show. Thank you, Celeste. Was very interested in what the doctor had to say. I think you used 80% of your finances in the last medical finances in the last 20% of your life, where you're basically swimming uphill, diminishing quality of life. My father passed away now, but he was 92, and he got on that ferry between the nursing home and the hospital. And it was extremely frustrating for us. And I think it had to do with something with the Medicaid or Medicare running out. And then the nursing home would ship him to the hospital for a time. Then the hospital would go ahead and ship him back to the nursing home, and he'd stay there until, you know, the same thing repeated itself. Medicare or Medicaid ran out. And also, too, I was wondering, Celeste, if your guest could speak to the higher acuity of the residents in nursing homes. In other words, people in nursing homes now are quite a bit sicker. They're not really nursing homes per se. These people are quite a bit sicker now than they used to be. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'm glad you made your second point, because it's true, and I don't really discuss that in the book I've written. But it's absolutely true, just as patients in hospitals are sicker. And nursing homes today are like regular homes in this sense. People are discharged from hospitals either postoperatively or much earlier in the case of an infection like pneumonia than they used to be, which means whether it's an institutional home, the nursing home, or a home, the people in the homes need to do many more medical things than they used to. Their home ventilators, their home IV administration is routine. Home wound care of a fairly advanced kind is routine. There are visiting nurses, their home health aides, that visit, but people in nursing homes are, yes, much sicker than they were 30 years ago on average. The level of what the listener calls acuity, meaning how sick somebody is higher, and the nursing homes, the pattern of reimbursement for nursing homes isn't geared for that. So nursing homes, which tend to operate as small businesses, many of them, view that kind of taking care of those kinds of patients as something they don't want to do. Get them back out of their care as fast as possible or don't take them in on the front end.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I practiced as a critical care specialist for over 10 years, and one of the problems I ran into quite often is that, you know, the dying patient is offered a ventilator, intubation, or nothing, instead of a ventilator or general anesthesia. You know, you will not suffer. We will give you enough morphine and other medications, so you will be under general anesthesia and not suffer one bit. And when put in that manner, families are much more willing to forego this wretched excess of life support death, which can often drag on for so long with more suffering and great expense to everybody. So, but the problem comes when you have the a few very active culture of life people of faith who are upset by this. They think it's euthanasia and actually bring doctors up on charges for killing patients. And, you know, New Orleans, something happened there where a grand jury had to dismiss those complaints. And in my own case, I was brought up, there was a hospital vice president of Medical Affairs, was a culture of life type person, one of these people who are very ardent in their views, and, you know, it just kept coming at me with accusations that I was about euthanasia. So that's, I would like to hear what your thoughts are on that. Thanks.
Okay. Right. Well, let me, you've said quite a bit, and so I'm just going to comment on a few aspects of it. The first is that I think the way medicine needs to go, and their movements, and I'll mention them in just a moment, is to be very, to let patients know in these, when the end of their life is near, that it's not either or, that the technology of that you just described in critical care of intubation and artificial ventilation and so forth, it's labeled life-saving. Do you want, you know, life-saving technology or not? There is a palliative approach in which people can be weaned off ventilators or not get ventilators and not experience much suffering. A whole field of palliative care, especially, is arising, and the people who practice it are very deft in knowing how to handle things like the need for hydration near the end of life, the need for fluids, the need for nutrition, how to handle the symptoms of air hunger, how to handle agitation, so that one can offer patients treatments using, you mentioned morphine, using opiates, using sedatives, being alert to patient symptoms and managing them, where the intention is to make the patient more comfortable. The intention is not to shorten the patient's life. And it's been the phenomenon of this kind of end-of-life care, or dying, if you will, has been studied, and it's been found that when these palliative measures are put in compared to people who get aggressive measures, people receiving the palliative measures end their lives more comfortably, not necessarily in a shorter way, but in a more comfortable way. And I've been impressed. One of the groups I'm working with in Chicago is the American College of Surgeons, where there is a core group with the executive director and a number of senior surgeons at the American College who have said palliative care is a core competency for surgeons, and we are going to start a training program for all surgical residents in the United States in palliative care. And they've teamed up with a foundation called Kniff Dixon, and the goal is to educate early career physicians, in this case surgeons, in the sense of what it means to be a surgeon with basic knowledge of palliative care as it relates to surgical practice. So I think there are some ways in which things are changing. The other point I'd make about the medical legal liability of physicians who do it is, to my knowledge, nobody has been successfully prosecuted who has documented a palliative intent in treating patients at the end of life. There have been charges brought, but nobody has been convicted. In other words, a physician has not been convicted who is in good faith employed palliative means of making patients who are dying comfortable and has documented what he or she has done. So that I think American medicine will have to go this way, because what we're doing now is causing too much suffering. And the knowledge to lessen suffering is there. It is not killing people at all. It's doing things that people that allow patients to be more comfortable as their lives are ending anyway.
Let's take another call. A listener in Chicago, line 4. Good afternoon.
Thank you. A wonderful program, and I appreciate the significance as I'm approaching those years. I'd like to comment about the matter of diagnosis, and you're getting second opinion, and even third opinion, and if you have to go out of town to get another opinion. But the matter reminds me of little stories. I remember the case of Eleanor Roosevelt having relied upon the cure that she certainly could get for a condition that arose later in her life, and the doctor prescribed medication. And subsequently, she visited again and said, things aren't changing much, and he said, well, let's continue on, it'll take a little time. And this went on for a while, and after this prolonged treatment, she needed attention, went to see him, and he was away, and an alternate doctor was there to take care of his cases. And he looked her over and says, you know, this medication is not for you. I don't believe in the diagnosis of the original doctor. Gave her a new diagnosis, new medication. She subsequently, of course, had been suffering from the side effects of the original medication. And there's a case of care was going awry. And the second point was knowing how Senator Ken Kennedy had his unfortunate condition with the neurological brain condition, but going back to earlier accidents he had in his life where he was racked up, bones broken and muscles and all that, and seeking help from the best doctors in his area. And the doctors came in and said, well, you're going to have this year operation to put things back together, and you'll be on the mend. He said, but it's not without risk, and so you have to call in your family and let them know. And so he started calling a member of the family. He said, but why don't you get a second opinion? Another colleague came in, said, well, I agree with my other doctor that you should have the operation. Okay. I figured they were going to have the operation. And some friends were coming in to wish him well. And one said, you know, I know a doctor doesn't believe in all these operations. He said, get me that doctor. He subsequently recuperated, didn't need an operation. So when you case of someone prescribing an operation and subsequent suffering that ensues with those kind of things, and some other alternative second opinion that might be different, it's well appreciated to have other opinions. And I could go on and on with this kind of points, but I thought I'd mention that. Thank you very much.
Okay, you want to comment?
Yes. Well, let me thank the caller. Many people do get second opinions, particularly when they're because there's a multiplicity of treatment possibilities. Will a medical treatment be appropriate? Will a surgical treatment? Will a procedure that's done by a physician, not a surgeon, but it's still a procedure, be appropriate? Which is the way to go? And for people with rare conditions, where there are only a handful of centers in the United States that are familiar with the situation, with the diagnosis, I think, yes, if one can, it behooves one to get to that center and find the person or persons, the physicians, who have treated 200 examples of a rare problem versus somebody who has seen 3 examples. You'll tend to have, you know, a better outcome and be have the option of getting a wider array of of treatments and perhaps more up-to-date and effective treatments. For people who have more garden variety problems, I think one thing to be aware of, and again, it's been studied, so it's been studied by others, not myself, is the sense that how one is treated, the treatments that are offered, to some extent depend on the locality in where you live, that both at the level of hospitals and at the level of specialist communities, what goes on in one region, what the local people are used to doing, is what will tend to be done with you for any given problem compared to if you live somewhere else. In other words, there's enormous variability at the level of hospitals. If you have a certain kinds of heart problems and you live in Boston or you live in New Haven, Connecticut, cities that are not that far apart, you're much more likely to be hospitalized in Boston, 60% more likely than in New Haven. You won't do any better in Boston, but you're more likely to be hospitalized. To turn to some kinds of orthopedic joint problems, in Florida, where it's been studied, if you live in one part of Florida, you're much more likely to have surgery on your back for certain kinds of back problems than if you live in another, because the orthopedic surgeons in the first part of Florida are much more used to doing that procedure and much more in favor of it than in the second. The outcomes in that study, again, 6 months later, were about the same. Patients were doing about as well, whether they had the intervention or not. So there's enormous variation from one community to another, both at the level of individual practitioner and at the level of hospital.
We're running down on time, and before we finish up, I want to talk about some people that there are stories in the book who are very vulnerable. And there are a number of stories in the book where folks are very vulnerable, children in particular. But there are others as well. In the chapter Life in the Narrows, you write, "Our healthcare approaches squander billions on extravagant treatment regimes that end up accomplishing little. As a society, we refuse to adopt the small, even tiny adjustments that could easily reduce the clawing uncertainties that now degrade millions. Why do we go for the extravagant and fail to look at the small ways we could alleviate suffering? And what are some of these small adjustments that we could make that would make such a difference?"
I think the small adjustments in the overall scheme of things are of availability of primary care in community-based contexts, the community health center. This was a centerpiece of a health reform act that the Nixon administration sponsored after the Johnson administration introduced it. And this meant putting physicians, and nowadays we'd have nurse practitioners and physicians' assistants, in community settings that are available to people on a regular basis, on a modest ability to pay scale. That, in other words, people for whom don't qualify for Medicaid and don't have insurance. It is a relatively low-cost way to do things. Their effectiveness has been demonstrated numerous times. They were part of the American healthcare landscape in the early 1970s. They're gradually become more and more endangered. Their funding has gone away. And when one looks at the history of that over 30 years, one finds that some of the vested interests, large hospitals through the American Hospital Association and their legislative arm, have lobbied not to fund community health centers. Instead, they have lobbied for more money for acute care hospitals. So what one finds on the street is the diabetic cannot get routine care to help him or her manage their diabetes and live a pretty stable life. something gets out of whack, as it can do with diabetes. They become metabolically deranged. They need a serious emergency attention. They're in intensive care units. There's a great deal of suffering. Sometimes they die much earlier than they would otherwise. And it's because there's no routine on the ground available care. Hospitals have shut down outpatient clinics. Hospitals have redistributed resources towards funding areas that generate high value added, high profit, if you will, procedures, and underfunded or eliminated routine garden variety effective primary care and disease management clinics because they will argue they don't pay. So, you know, what's changed is instead of saying we have a mission, we, the people in organized medicine and our institutions, have a mission, and we will figure out how to get it done. If you go to hospital boardrooms these days and healthcare corporations, whether they're nonprofit or for-profit, the mantra is no margin, meaning no profit, no mission. And I think that's a tragic and morally indefensible inversion of our traditional roles.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Robert Martinson, he is the author of A Life Worth Living, A Doctor's Reflections on Illness in a High-Tech Era. Dr. Robert Martinson is a physician, medical historian, and bioethicist. He has treated tens of thousands of patients in emergency rooms and intensive care units. He is currently director of the Office of History and Museum at the National Institutes of Health. He also serves on the faculty of the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. A Life Worth Living is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.